kids. It's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
What's up, everybody? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. Joining as usual, Cole, how are you?
I was waiting for you to tell me not to shut up. That's Why? How I am. I'm just sitting here waiting because you yelled at us to shut up before we started recording.
That's true.
And I have to sit and wait for you to say
I addressed you directly.
I'm letting everybody know how poorly you treat us off the air.
Will you shut your fucking face?
Fuck off, Joe.
He's even worse on the air.
I was at first
goddamn kids
our inability to sense joy, but now I just realize that did Joe take that ability from her through SML abuse?
SML abuse.
Joe,
SML, some masochistic living. Joy.
I used to be a beacon of joy, and then I started this show.
You're welcome, world.
My little light of glee has been snuffed out, and now I'm
now
just
you're just
darkness
a beacon of black
anger.
Licorice.
You're just a ball of hatred.
Yep, literal ball too. Just because I'm that fat now, sitting here playing games all the time, that I'm just like a literal ball of mad.
So in the meantime, what you gotta do is you gotta find joy in that. You gotta become a ball of smiles. So the way to do that is to roll down hills in a joyous manner. That becomes an active game. And then when you're done doing that, you can still play a video game. But you'll be happier when you do it. Makes no damn sense. Anyway, point is, you got to become a happy ball, not a sad or frustrated ball, because there's no point in that. We got to find a cure for SML abuse.
Don't try and get philosophical on here.
2020.
There once was a man who knew how to
don't get philosophical and hopeful. There is no room for hope in this world right now.
Oh, that's not true. I find hope in all the games that kick the shit out of me. I promise you that.
What games are kicking the shit out of you, Purnell?
Oh, one of which I will be talking about tonight. But otherwise, honestly, I think it's been a different form of that. Now, what I'm experiencing is, so as a lot of people on this show know, I'm a big fan of the Lana game. And so as I played that, you know, it's a difficult game. It is a puzzler first and a platformer second, which is something a lot of people don't realize when they pick it up. And they use it to the game's detriment when they say, I didn't like this game, it's too hard. Anyway, point is, I couldn't get anywhere. This is stupid. It's like the game is tough, but when I played through it, I was able to get through it. There was probably like maybe two times where I was like, screw this, internet saved my ass. But for the most part, I was able to get through the game. Now that I'm playing with a lot of other people and discussing it with them as they play through it, I'm seeing where other people get stuck. And it's always shocking to me. Like, I had one friend who was playing the second game, and you know, normally you get started getting stuck maybe like 2 hours into the game, you know, when you start opening up all the other areas. But this friend was trying to find one of the first sub-weapons, and he came across it at the store, the game store first. But you can't, it's like Zelda, you can't buy ammo for a weapon until you find the weapon. Like, you can't buy arrows for a bow if you didn't find the bow yet, you know? So he was like, oh, well, I found the shuriken, but I can't buy them. I was like, yeah, because you have to find it in the dungeon first. It's in the intro dungeon section of the game. Okay.
Spoiler alert.
Well, too bad. If you get spoiled by intro, that's your ass. So then at that point, I got contacted about it again where I was like, well, you need the shuriken to break that wall. He's like, well, I can't get the shuriken because the guy won't sell it to me. I'm like, he won't sell it to you because you haven't found it yet. Like, it was this circular logic of trying to convince him to just look for the freaking item. And it was like, okay, if you're stuck here, you're in deep shit when the game opens up. Because, oh, God. And there's other stuff like that, too, with different people. They have, like, they're stuck at different puzzles. And it really makes me wonder, like, what do people generally feel like when they find a point in a game that just hits them hard? Whether it's a puzzle game and you can't solve a certain puzzle, or an action game where you just can't beat that boss. Like, do you crawl up into a ball and, like, just can't take it? You want to quit? Does it drive you to keep pressing on until you finally pull it off? Like, is it a little combination?
I play something else.
You just play, you just like, you'll play something else.
Yeah, I don't have the time or the patience to deal with stupidly hard games right now. I have too much to play the way it is. Yeah, clearly the skill, that's a given.
Well, also keep in mind, when I say hard, I don't even particularly mean stupidly hard. Like, yeah,
I know, just hard in general. Like, I'll give it a try. I'll try a couple of times, but if it's something that's just driving me up a wall, I'm not going to let it bother me. I'll just quit and do something else.
Yeah, that's usually what I do too. I just have to quit and call it a day.
Dude, I can dig that too, because like, there's something different about a game that's tough, but then when you're losing to it, it spurs you on. Like, I'm going to beat this because I'm determined. But it's another thing if the losses in the game genuinely and bona fidely frustrate you. Because at that point, you're truly not really having fun. Like, if you can't, if you're the type that will get frustrated and it doesn't drive you, then it's not fun anymore. And that point is like time to move on to a different game. Like, because me, I think there are definitely certain games where I can't drive myself to just press on it. There's usually games where it's a skill ceiling in a genre that I'm not good at to begin with. Like, say, fighters, like 2D fighters. I can play them to an extent, but due to the way they play, I'll never be like even mid tier. I'll always be low tier to like beating my head until it gets the wall until I just break through it good, but never playing against a skilled player and just like reading their moves and shit. Or if I do, I'm always going to screw up the button inputs and not get the moves off like I want to. So it's like, fuck this game. Like, I can't, there's no amount of perseverance is going to get me better at those games. It's just not in me.
That's why I stay offline a lot too, because I know I'm just, Tim, you're right. I don't have the skill that I used to have when I was younger and, you know, halfway decent at games. I could still hold my own at Tetris at least, but.
How do you do a Tetris 99?
A lot of seconds, thirds. I've yet to actually win, surprisingly. Every time it's a Japanese name.
Yeah, you got to play when
they're asleep. That sounds about right. You play a Japanese person in Magical Drop 3 screw it.
Yeah, I think that's legit, like, what someone's advice was at one point. It's like, if you want to win at Tetris 99, you have to play when Japan is asleep.
Yeah.
I don't know when exactly that is. I've won it all times of day, but
I don't play nearly as much as I want to. Like, every time they have a weekend event, I'm like, I'm gonna fucking play the shit out of that this weekend, and I never touch it.
Yeah, well, I picked it up because they had the Animal Crossing event.
I missed out on that one.
Yeah, I picked up that, and yeah, like, it was the first time I've played since like January, February, and I got like second place my first round and first by like my fifth round.
Nice.
Yeah.
So for those events, do you have to actually get like first place or something to get the skin, or you just have to play?
They give you points. So you have to get like 100 points total, and depending on how high you rank, you get more points. Like, if you get first place, yes, you get 100 points, and then boom, you can turn it off and walk away. But I think second is like 50, and then below that you might get like 5, 10, 15, 20, 25. So, you know, you play a few matches and you can grind it out. But they also do it where, like, you can actually get, like, gold points for the store, depending on how high you rate, like, in total. Like, I don't know exactly how they calculate it, like, if you just play a shitload or whatever. But there was one time where I got a prize in my email that was, like, a bunch of, I think it was in-game currency, or maybe it was gold coins. I don't remember what it was, actually. But, yeah, I actually did win something for my placement.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Oh, honestly, I feel like I wish they would do more 99 style games, but somehow
they're called battle royale games. They're everywhere, Purnell.
Yeah.
Well, I mean specifically in regards to puzzle games.
Yeah.
Puyo 99
formula than just like third person, first person shooters would be cool.
Mm-hmm. Like Magical Drop 99. Good lord, I'd be
ridiculous. God.
I want to play Tetris Attack 99.
That would also be the amount of brain power that would be required for that. Good God.
Hey, did you play Panel Dupont in the last week?
I did. I've already beaten it on
the hardest. Yeah, me too. Mode. Same. Yeah. It was a lot of it was cool to see it.
Yeah, I actually do own it on the Super Famicom as well as Tetris Attack. Oh, that's like my game. Well, I have one game, and it's that. Okay, that and Skyrim, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to say Skyrim.
I had a time when I was... 99.
Tetris Attack is a game I can take out into public and, you know, like, play people, and they actually will care and be impressed.
If someone got really good at writing a quest algorithm, you totally could do something out of Skyrim 99. In fact, I'm almost positive that there is a game out there that exists that was like a versus RPG, where the whole point was to race to get through a series of quests before the other player.
Oh, like that. There was, what the hell was it called? I don't remember what it was called. There was like a fantasy themed one. Realm Royale, that's what it was, that came out a couple years ago.
Mm. Yeah, it turned into a chicken when he died.
Yeah, it was all right. I played a little bit of it. It was okay. I'm sure there's been other ones that have come out since then. There's been no lack of battle royales.
I don't know. I've never gotten into the battle royale genre. The only two battle royales I've played any or put any kind of actual time into are Tetris 99 and the battle royale mode that they added to Forza Horizon 4.
Wait, there's a battle royale in Forza Horizon?
Yeah.
You damn right they are.
Is it crashing or just racing in with elimination?
Racing and elimination.
Okay. That sounds like it'd be a pretty crowded course too. Like, 99 cars.
Well, have you played Forza Horizon 4?
I have not. I figure racing.
It's game. Fucking huge. Someone needs to play Forza Horizon. That's the next game we're going to bug you to play, Forza Horizon 4.
I'm still waiting to hear some feedback on games that I've been talking about. We got to get some dialogue. Where you at, man?
Hey, I'm thinking about playing La Mulana soon and giving it a solid try.
You got to do that. Do that. I'm all about game recommendation trades. Like, hey, here, try this game. Bonus if you already own it. It's like, all right, sure, I'll do that. And then when it's done, it's like, all right, in exchange for that, you need to try
now this you game. Need to play this.
I love that it's
and
simply
of course, the only requirement, it has to be a game you actually like. You can't go into your reserve of games that traumatize you and go, play that shit.
So you need to be ruined like I was ruined.
You wouldn't play Layers of Fear?
I feel like I've heard about that, actually. That was like the game where the image of for the game card is like a portrait.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Y'all, I got this great game. It's called Decay of Logos.
Oh, my God.
You gotta try
prime
it.
Example. No.
I'm now.
Don't. Shoot, that'd be like me saying, yo, you should play Ephemeral Fantasia because I hate everyone.
Oh, man. Poor Decay of Logos. It tried so hard.
Yeah.
It decayed.
I I love, by the way, that it's only a bonus if you own the game already, not a given. Let me recommend this game that you already own.
But it happens to me all the time, which is amazing to me in its own right. It's like I probably own more games than anybody I know, with the exception of probably Joe. And people can still refer me to games that I don't have yet. I'm like, or even to play with them. Like, hey, Pernell, you want to play this game with me online? I'm like, I don't have that. I own 1,000+ games. You could name one that I own. How is that possible? And they're like, well, let's you should just buy it. Play with me. I'm like, how about this?
Let me see if I can name one and whether or not you have it. Night in the Woods.
I do have that. Here's the thing, though. I'm not saying that it's impossible for you to not own a game. Like, there are thousands of video games out there, and I own a fraction of those. But what I am saying is that I don't know a ton of people that dive into the murky depths of obscure games. They're generally playing games that are floating near or at the surface of the water of gaming. So if someone came to me and said, for example, like Joe just mentioned, you want to play Forza Horizon 4? I don't own it, yes. But I think you can admit that Forza Horizon is pretty a well-known franchise. It's not obscure, right? So, like,
and it's on Game Pass.
It's on Game Pass, which makes it even easier. I don't have to buy it. But, like,
14 minutes, by the way. 14 minutes, if that was on your office pool. 14 minutes by the time we got to Game Pass.
God, I didn't know there was a pool. But yeah, it's like, so to name something like Forza Horizon, it would make sense. Even if I don't have it, I could at least say, you know, it makes sense to name that. But a lot of time, people will name games that are like clearly out of left field for me, but they're mainstream nonetheless. And it's like, how do I not, how are you going to name that one game that I don't have, but thousands I do have? How about you play one of the games I own with me? Not because I'm being arrogant, but because I've spent enough. Let me keep some money.
Justify me owning all of this crap.
Yeah. It's like, you think about it, though. It's like, I own a lot of video games. I spend a lot of money to get set games. I need to rein that shit in. Just play what I got. That's the general tagline. So for when someone to come along and say, hey, Pernell, play this game with me that you have to also purchase. It's like, you're not helping me at all. Yeah. You know, play the games that I have with me. It's not going to hurt you to buy one game. Like, I buy three games a year. I buy 30. You can buy
one of those people has a problem.
Yeah. Well, clearly the guy who buys three, he needs to buy more games. Buy more shit.
You say just 30? That's it? Come on, Pernell, step it up.
I totally speculate. I don't even know, but I know I buy a lot. Like, I look at my shelf over there. There's enough games, and that's not even factoring the digital shit. Like,
yeah, I don't want to count.
I don't buy games because I do this show, but I was going to say 30 is like a month for how many reviews we knock out.
Yeah, I came across a Facebook memories from 1 year ago when I logged how many Switch games I owned, and that number has increased by at least 200 now.
God, don't even get me started on the Switch. I'm re-downloading all of my games right now. I'm up to the R's.
Radical.
Rotunda. Wait a minute.
Rex.
Yeah, that's a game.
Speaking of all the reviews you guys do, should we get to the reviews?
Yeah, there's kind of on the docket for this evening. Just
let it go.
Yeah, we got a bunch to talk about. Pernell, you were talking about Murky Depths, and that reminded me of the first game we're going to talk about tonight.
There's that segue.
Shitty segue.
Yeah, oh,
here
buddy.
It comes.
Murky motherfucker.
First game to talk about tonight is called Maneater, developed in...
We're getting nowhere tonight.
Developed and published by Tripwire Interactive, released May 22nd on Xbox One, PS4, and Epic Game Store for $39.99. Experience the ultimate power fantasy as the apex predator of the seas, a terrifying shark. Maneater is a single-player open-world action RPG, a shark PG, where you are the shark, devour nutrients to grow and evolve far beyond what nature intended, become a massive shark and apex predator of legends to get revenge on the cruel fishermen that dismembered you, eat, explore, evolve. Tim, tell us about Maneater.
Man, they know what game they made, didn't they? Shark PG. Come on now. Yeah, this is an open world action RPG in the vein of, you know, if I don't know if you've played any Ubisoft game in the last few years. I mean, I guess you don't have to climb radio towers to see what's in the area. Though I wouldn't put it past this game. There was a point like early on where I bit something underwater and I thought that that's what I had just done, but no, that was not the case. It does not have radio towers, but it does have, like, you know, a certain number of side missions that you go and do, and just the way things ramp up. Definitely, you know, it's that genre, and this game is fucking stupid. so, like,
that's so me.
Oh, it's great. And you know, it has problems, but it's great.
Those were your first words to me too. Like, before, like, 2 days into you reviewing the game, I'm like, hey, how's Maneater so far? I'm curious because it's kind of on my wish list. You're like, it's fucking stupid. It's great.
Yeah.
I'm not even gonna lie, I'm playing it right now.
Why lie?
Yeah.
It falls into a kind of a space of game that I missed from like the PS2 360 years, like the B level game, you know, these games that would come out for $30 or $40 and be kind of janky, but they'd be like weird.
Mr. Mosquito.
Yeah, like just like weird, strange stuff that was, you know, not perfect, but was like a lot of fun. And more importantly to me, at least, is that they're unique and they did different things. And this is a game where you play as a shark and you don't get to do that very often. it's I never played Jaws Unleashed. Speaking of B level games from the PS2 era, I never played Jaws Unleashed. But you know, I've seen people make that comparison. There's a little bit of that. There's a little bit of a little bit of like EVO in there when I think of games where you're a creature eating other creatures. A little bit of that. But yeah. So, anyways, this game opens up and kind of very quickly wants to introduce you to all of its shark mechanics. As you are, it starts you off with like a full grown shark and is like, okay, go here, eat this, go here, eat some humans, and then you start getting attacked by hunters. And inevitably, that shark gets killed and captured by the antagonist of the game, Scaly Pete, who then, you know, who strings up said shark on his boat and then is like, oh, this one is with child. Cuts open the shark, pulls out you. You are the baby shark. Pulls you from your mother's womb. and then cuts you so he'll know what shark you are in the future, at which point your little baby shark bites his hand off and he throws you into the swamp. And thus the game begins proper. So you start out as a little baby shark in the swamp, and you know, your first objectives are just like swim around, eat some catfish, eat some groupers, just eat some small fish and watch out for alligators because they will fuck you up. And you know, like many of these open world, like action RPG modern Assassin's Creed hybrids, like you will see the level of the other creatures in the world, as they relate to yourself. And so that will give you an idea of how dangerous or large they may be compared to you. So you go around and you start completing quests and evolving upwards. Each kind of area in the game, the game's broken up into 7 or 8 different areas of different bodies of water, I guess, that are all interconnected. Each one will have a grotto where you can go to reflect, evolve, and think about self-love. That's what the narrator says.
Okay.
So I guess I should also say the game is narrated by like a guy doing narration for a nature show. The backbone theme of the game is that this is a nature show following this one shark, sort of.
I actually heard that the narrator is the guy, Chris Parnell from Rick and Morty.
Is it? Like that's Chris Parnell? I heard.
Yeah.
I didn't look it up, but
if it's not the narrator, then it's at least the antagonist.
Oh. So yeah, there is that. So when you complete missions, when you find collectibles in the environment, because there are collectibles in the environment, you know, you'll get a little bit of narration from this narrator, little bits of dialogue of just like what it has to do with the area, or sometimes it's always very tongue-in-cheek. Not every joke lands, but it's a very jokey thing. That's where the grottos is where you can explore the miracle of self-love comes from.
Son of a bitch, the narrator is Chris Parnell. That's incredible.
That's amazing. That's fantastic.
Oh my god, I need to buy this game.
You just picture Jerry talking to you about this shark.
So yeah, the more you eat, the more you level up, your shark will begin to evolve. And when you hit certain milestones, your shark gets bigger. When you complete certain quests, you will get, what are they called? Mutations. So like the first one you get is bioelectric teeth. So when you bite things, you have a chance to stun them or do like bonus electrical damage. There's more than just these, but the kind of the two main ones in the game are the electric shark mutations and the bone shark mutations. And you get modifications to like your teeth, your head, your fins, your fins, your tail, and your body. And all of these things give you different bonuses for either, like there's tons of stats in the game for like what you're doing, your defense, your bite power, your speed, your breaching ability when you jump out of the water, your damage to boats when you are attacking people with boats, your lung capacity for when you are not in the water, And all of those mutations also have a cosmetic effect on your shark, which is great because you will look fucking weird by the end of this game. It was just like great when Lauren walked in after I'd picked up a bunch of the bioelectric mutations all at once. So I was like this giant, like, blue shark with like these weird wavy tentacles, but like a bony head and a bony tail. And she's just like, what is going on? And I'm just like, watch this. And I would do my dodge move, in which where the shark disappears momentarily into a bolt of electricity and shoots forward before rematerializing. So, you know, this game is not afraid to get weird in any respect of what it is doing. So usually the missions in a level will take the form of like, oh, go here, you know, population control, go to this area, eat 10 of this fish, go to this area, maybe. And there will be certain marked targets of other, predators in the area that you can attack and fight. I would not recommend that early on because they're all alligators. Actually, no, there are some other, there's like fish from the Finger Lakes that are in there, and it said in the game specifically notes, if you're wondering why fish from the Finger Lakes are down in the bayou, you are thinking too hard.
I gotta tell you, I like the bioelectric teeth, but the Finger Lakes fish is where I draw the line.
You can't have pike down in the bayou. That's just absurd. What are you doing? after you. Each area has a thing where you have to do population control to cut down like the base fish of the area, at which point the apex predator of the area will appear, which is just like a souped up version of one of the other, you know, predatory antagonistic sea creatures that might be around. So early on, it's alligators. That moves up to other sharks. That moves up to like it moves up, I guess. I'll say like part of the driving force behind me, like going forward in this game, was just to see like how far they would go, how big would things get, what would I be doing at the end of the game, you know? And that was fun to see. And also, there will inevitably be moments where you need to eat some humans. Traditionally, sharks, attacking and eating humans is an overblown phenomenon, but as your baby shark has a taste of human blood right at the beginning of its life by biting off Scaly Pete's hand, you have no problem tearing up humans. So there will be like areas where I don't know, I think early on just like humans are like in paddle boats, just paddling around out in the water. You can launch yourself out of the water, bite one of those suckers right off the paddle boat, eat them up. Very good. And the more people, and later on, I mentioned something about lung capacity, because eventually, like, you know, the people are up on beaches and you will just launch yourself out of water onto the beach and start flopping your way down the beach, biting humans and eating them before hopping back into water before you suffocate. You can leap onto the back of boats that are, you know, driving around. It's great and it's ridiculous and it's always fun. Just like there's people on the beach and here comes a shark just launching itself out of the water, flopping down the beach at them.
Well, you then the only question left.
No, I got more to say.
Oh, you got more to say.
Yeah, there's more to say. I'm not done yet. So, but after, if you eat enough humans, then your kind of alert level goes up, like your star rating in GTA, and hunters will start coming up, like bounty hunters will start showing up to try to bring your shark to justice. And the more hunters you kill, I mean, you could just run away from them and hide. There's like literally like an alert thing, like it's Metal Gear Solid. If you just hide from them, they'll eventually give up and go away. But if you fight the hunters, you can fight them, sink their boats, leap out of the water, bite them off of their boats, kill a bunch of hunters. Eventually a kind of named bounty hunter will show up. And if you defeat that hunter, then your level of overall infamy will go up. And you will usually get one of your mutation upgrades for that. So, and there's like 10 levels of that, whatever. But yeah, there's collectible like license plates, which sometimes are underwater. Sometimes they're out of the water, and you have to like leap out of the water to get them or flop around out of the water to get them. There are landmarks, which are, again, in and out of the water. You collect these things. Oh, and there's like little, I don't know, they're just resource chests. I don't remember what they're technically called, but they're just down there. They all give you upgrade stuff, which you can then use to upgrade all of your mutations and stuff like that. So you don't just get like these electric teeth. You can then upgrade them like five more levels to make them better electric teeth. And the different mutations have set bonuses if you equip more than one, which is great. This is all that's going on in the game. It's very ridiculous. The issues with the game is the combat, the shark-to-shark combat, is not great. It's a lot of just kind of mashing the bite button. There is a lock-on, but it just does not fucking work. Like, the second something goes off camera, like, instead of the camera swinging around to keep it in your view, the lock-on just breaks. Which can be frustrating when you're used to games where you want to lock on to things and keep an eye on them. It doesn't work in this game. There's really not a lot of reason to use it. So the combat boils down to a lot of like dodging, trying to swing the camera around to figure out where said opponent went, and just line yourself back up to go biting at them. It's a little shallow. But
mercy.
I wish it worked better. Like, there, you have a dodge, you have a tail whip. You do have an ability to, when you can bite something in your jaws and then tail whip it away from you at other things. That doesn't really come up very much.
If a human comes along, you must whip it.
Yes, I really want to bite things and then just tail whip them out of the damn water so they suffocate and die. But, you know, it just, at the end of the day, when fighting a lot of things, it was just a matter, especially like the larger creatures later on, it was just like trying to line them up so I could then bite them at like the ocean floor or a wall or something like that. So they would just get stuck and I could just bite the shit out of them until they died. There is definitely a bit of fat in this game when you think about how, like I said, in every area, three times you have to go around and eat like 10 gropers or 10 fucking clownfish or 10 seals or whatever in three different locations. It's just like a little bit, like, it doesn't take a lot of time, but it's just like, come on, like
padding,
do something here. Yeah. There could have been like a couple more activities. It's like, goddamn this fucking game for making me wish that, like, oh, I wish I had to do races where I had to swim up and down to go through rings. Like, this is what this game has done to me. Just like, I wish I did a little bit of that. Just to change things up from like swim here, eat a bunch of this shit, swim here, eat a bunch of this shit. But
I hate races, so don't give them ideas for DLC. Yeah,
ideas. but hey, swimming around, like, one of the mechanics I didn't mention is like when you are at the top of the water, like, your fin will stick out and you swim extra fast, which is like a great way to get around most areas. And yeah, but you will, game's probably about like 10, 12 hours long, so it doesn't overstay its welcome. And it keeps, despite those moments where it's kind of grindy, and there is a few areas later on where they're literally just like, you have to clear 40% of this area to move on. And it's just like, come on, God damn it. like, there was definitely like a bit of grinding at a few points where I just had to like go around and like grind out a couple missions or collectibles. I had to grind a little bit to hit the level cap at the end, but it despite being annoying, those things didn't take that long to do, and the game is just so weird and fun and ridiculous the whole way through. I think it's worth putting up with kind of its shortcomings.
Well, then your verdict at $40?
It is to buy it. The game, I believe, is a no-brainer for like $30, but I still think it's worthwhile and entertaining and unique for $40. And I've seen deals for at least the Epic Games code for like $30, $32 already. If you have any interest in the idea of being a shark, you should definitely check this out.
Well, during your review, I cashed in all of my Microsoft rewards and I bought Maneater.
The best thing you could have used those rewards for, I'm telling you.
Yeah. Are you enjoying it, Cole?
Yeah, I'm just sitting here thrashing away. I'm like, yeah. Get fucked, catfish.
It's just like, yeah, you can get bored, but then it's just like, ah, you know what? I'm going to go kill these humans over here, and it's going to be a blast.
Bioelectric teeth.
Bioelectric teeth.
Oh, Lord, I can't wait. But next game to talk about. What?
Sorry. I was doing the Jaws thing because I was going after something.
Oh. What are you going after?
Just catfish.
Oh.
You know.
So you're pretty
girl. They're tasty. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they are pretty delicious, so.
Nom nom nom.
Nom nom.
Anyway, next game to talk about is called Shantae and the Seven Sirens, developed and published by WayForward, released May 28th on Xbox One, Switch, PS4, and PC for $29.99. Shantae is back in an all-new tropical adventure. In her fifth outing, the half-genie hero gains new fusion magic abilities to explore a vast sunken city, makes new half-genie friends, and battles the Seven Sirens in her biggest, most thrilling quest yet, featuring multiple towns and more labyrinths than ever before, an awesome aquatic journey full of danger and discovery awaits. Purnell, tell us about the new Shantae.
I think it's funny that description makes the game sound way more epic than I ever thought a Shantae game would be. It's like, it's Shantae. What?
Shantae. But, you have played the previous Shantae's?
I have. Only one I haven't played any of so far was a Half Genie Hero, which sits at my shelf and laughs at me. But I've played either all of or a portion of all the other Shantae, even the elusive Game Boy one. Damn it, take a drink, take a shot every time we say Shantae.
Shantae.
That's what it was like last time I reviewed a Shantae game. Chris Huber was on it, which is Shantae. All day.
All day. That was sad. I was asking the other day. I played so much of this game. Like I got legitimately hooked on it. It was a fun time for me.
Tell us about it. What is Shantae and the Seven Sirens?
We give him the chance.
Shantae is
we're never getting through this review.
She is a half genie, half human individual who normally is guarding Sequinland, but for the purpose of this game, she's actually on vacation with her friends to a cool island whose name eludes me. I just know that the main hub town is Arena Town. And as a result, during this visit, she is there hanging out with other half genies who she's meeting for the first time. And then poof, smack, bam, lights go out and all but she are taken away and thrown into dungeons hidden throughout the sunken depths of Arena Town. So unlike a lot of games of this style, one thing I thought about this game that was pretty interesting is that it's a typical Metroidvania style game, but the majority of the game takes place in underwater labyrinths that then lead to dungeons.
Water levels suck, boo.
Well, the positive is, I will say in this game though, this is one of those games where the water levels aren't so bad because
you changed my mind.
That was easy. So how she goes about looking for these friends is pretty much the meat and potatoes of the game. The game consists of Shantae exploring the island surrounding Arena Town, some of the towns that she discovers that are on the surface, but then she goes underground, or rather underwater, to subterranean labyrinths where she explores and looks for the labyrinths where the individual side of Seven Sirens or the individual half genie women are imprisoned. So the game has a pretty particular gameplay loop that goes on with it, in which you go underground. Well, it usually starts out like after the first girl, and then it becomes a typical loop, but for the most part you go underground, you explore a bit, find dungeon, get through a portion of the dungeon, and then you fight Risky Boots, who is Shantae's adversary. She is pretty much the proto man of this game, which I think is probably one of the only things that annoyed me is that every dungeon in the game, you have to fight Risky Boots at some point. And it's the same fight with just a few more attacks that she gets. And I'm just like, come on now. You could have done something more with her. It's like, she's like kind of the exposition character of the game. Like, what's going on? Why are you here, Risky Boots? You got to fight me to find out. And then you fight her and you win. So why are you here? I'm here for the treasure. And then she leaves. And then the next dungeon, you fight her again. It's like, Risky Boots. Yeah, it's like, what are you doing here? Tell me more about the treasure. I'll tell you about the treasure if you beat me for it. And then you beat her. She's like, so tell me about the treasure. It's big. Whoosh, and she leaves again. And you're like, okay, this is getting real stupid. So at that point, I got to the point where she was showing up. I was like, I don't even give a shit. Let me just beat up Risky Boots. I don't even care what you have to say. You're a loser. I'm kidding. I love Risky Boots. But nonetheless, I was getting annoyed by her lack of exposition before and after battles. But you beat her, then you locate one of the seven, one of the half genies, and she gives you one of the new elements to the game, which is called a fusion coin. Fusion coins replace the dances, the transformation dances of the previous Shantae games. And I actually did, this is a element of the game that I like that they changed. So back in the day, for example, let's say you wanted to climb a wall where you have to hold down the button, go into the Shantae dance, shucka shucka, and then you turn to a monkey and now you can climb walls. And there's like this weird element of time that you have to kind of stop to do the dance and whatever. But in this game, when you get fusion coins, you get the ability to transform into an animal as a move. So in this case of the game, if you want to climb a wall, the first fusion coin you get is that of a newt, a dash newt. You jump in the air, you press the dash button, she turns into a newt, and she dashes. It's an instantaneous action. There's no stopping to transform, nothing. And it keeps the momentum of the game going very strong, in my opinion. I came to like it. You could, like, transform into the newt, go for a dash, then jump, and then you can turn to the bonk tortoise and just stomp. And it's just, it's nice. It's, I like how they did that. That was a very convenient change. You typically find one transformation per dungeon when you rescue a girl, and then you have to use that dungeon, a la Zelda, to complete the remainder of the dungeon and fight the boss, who likely requires you to use the new transformation in order to defeat her. Who are the bosses? The seven sirens, obviously. Didn't you read the title? Yes, it's seven of them. They're jerks, and then you beat them up. And once you beat them, you get ejected from the dungeon, in which case then you get a little bit of like dialogue with the newly rescued half-genie. And then you send you on another little quest throughout the island where you ultimately end up coming across something called a fusion stone. And what the fusion stone does is it allows you to combine, quote unquote, combine magics with one of the half genies, which gives you a new fusion ability. Now, this is something that I was kind of let down on. It's not a game killer. It's just when I originally heard about, you know, you get new fusion abilities, I was expecting like become like a combination of two genies and like get cool beat 'em up powers or something, you know? Like now I'm like a genie who's half squid, half girl, and beating dudes up. But instead, what fusion magic is in this game, it's essentially a puzzle element. So that's when you go into a dance. Say, for example, the first one you get is a fusion that allows you to see the unseen, a.k.a. scan ability. So you go into the dance, you select the scan dance. She like a bit of a JPEG image of a fusion Shantae. And then the ability just triggers, and you just get whatever happens, happens. So in the case of the scan ability, you'll just see stuff pop up on the screen that was hidden before. And all of the abilities work in that manner. One will allow you to just like flash the screen with the JPEG image of a fusion, and then you'll make things grow or something like that. So it's not bad, but it was more, it's a puzzle item, not so much a cool fusion ability. So I was kind of slightly let down by that. But that is essentially the gameplay loop. Rescue sister, get new coin, beat boss, get out of dungeon, locate new fusion coin to get new ability, which allows you to unlock access to the next area, which takes you to the next dungeon, wash, rinse, repeat. But there's a few little like mini side quests throughout the game too, where you might like have to get like an item to trade to somebody, which gets you access to one more element in the loop to get you to the next fusion coin or something. There is also, honestly, something worth mentioning that I thought about the game is that the music in this game, it's very different from most other Shantae games, in my opinion.
Yeah, Vert is not back, which shocked me, and I'm really bummed about to hear that Jake is not part of the music this time around.
Yeah, I honestly was sad to hear that too, but on the positive, I will say it's not Jake Kaufman. Because let's be honest, nothing's really Jake Kaufman. He ain't topping that dude. But the guy that they, or well, at least one of the guys in particular, they got to work on the OST, did a pretty decent job of it. I heard one of the tracks in particular that immediately made me realize who it was. And when I looked it up, I confirmed it. Back in the day, I reviewed a game called The Mummy Demastered, which is basically.
I also remember that.
It's a good freaking game that I wish more people played. And the music was something that stood out to me in that game because at the time, it's the same dude.
Yep. Oh, he's good. Yeah.
If you go online after this episode, look up the Coral Mine theme. If you can remember the music in that game in The Mummy, it'll immediately click for you because his trademark sound is all over it. But the OST for this game, in my opinion, is not Vert, but it's still pretty good. So it didn't really hurt the game. It still makes it interesting to play through. It's a bit tropey, but at the same time, I don't really picture a lot of people playing Shantae games for an amazing tale or narrative. You're playing it because you want to beat things up with your hair as a pretty cool genie girl who you wish were in Smash Brothers. and that's
the game totally make you like revisit old areas a lot.
Yeah. I want to say you sort of do, but it's not in the manner that is irksome. I'm glad you asked that because it helps me mention something that I should have mentioned earlier. There are warp rooms throughout the game. Okay. So you'll eventually walk into a room, and I always kind of laugh when games do stuff like this where they'll have like a random attendant, like an employee of the island working in the warp room. Yet, at the same time, though they do tours of the subterranean area, generally, early on, they explain as if they can't get too far into the place because, you know, it's blocked off by debris or whatever, general puzzle elements. But you get to, like, the bottom of the ocean, and there's a warp room there, and an attendant's like, please step on the warp. I was like, how the hell did you get down here? First of all, there's the real question. And then another thing I kind of chuckled about, which is something worth mentioning for the game, is that when you beat monsters up in this game, you can get two different things. Three different things. One, you can find money, which can be used to purchase upgrades at the various shops in the game. Second thing you can get is food items. Food items are generally going into your inventory, and when you're about to die, or if you're just hungry, you can use one of the many food items to heal your health. And the last thing you can get, and something I didn't realize was a part of the game until playing it, is something called a monster card. It's essentially like a trading card that you can equip up to three of them. And when you equip the monster card, it gives you a passive ability. Like you might swim faster or crawl faster, or your hair might do more damage, or one of your magic attacks will do more damage. Yeah, that's what cards are all about, man. So you essentially go out and you kill. Certain monsters require you to get multiples of their cards in order to activate their ability. Sometimes you just get one card and it does the job. And honestly, even though a lot of the abilities are just kind of like, I don't really see the need for that ability, I still felt compelled to want to get the card for every monster I fought, because that's what a collector wants to do. He wants all the damn cards. Mm-hmm. So that was a bit of an appeal for me there. But there was an odd thing that made me chuckle just as an observation of the game, which is that most, if not all, the items you get on the Shantae item inventory screen are food items. You get like a salmon, you get golden crabs, you get canned tuna, all this food. And Shantae's just pigging out the entire damn island trek. Meanwhile, all the actual half G's are locked in cages underground, and they're stuck there until you get to them. So I just imagine she's running around the island, just gorging herself out of her mind, having a great vacation. And you get to the bottom, and these girls just like famished, malnourished. And she's like, hey, Shantae, here's a coin. Like, how about this? It's like, how about they say, thanks for saving me, Shantae. I'll give you this coin, but could you please give me a sandwich first? I'm really hungry. I've been trapped out here for the last, I don't know, 5 game hours, which in real time in this game is probably like 4 days. But come on, girl, just feed me. Give me something. But it was like a weird thing I noticed about the game, just a general observation. But it's honestly a enjoyable time. I found the game to be fun. I enjoyed coming across each dungeon area because even though the dungeons never really pose a challenge, it doesn't mean I didn't enjoy solving them. You know, basically going through the general find a key to open door to get to the next room, blah, blah, blah. You know, usual 2D dungeon gameplay. And the bosses themselves also are fairly fun and creative as well. Like, they were never hard, but I always enjoyed being like, okay, what's this trick to beating this guy? Oh, I see. I got to trigger this switch to make the guy go over here, which makes him vulnerable. You know, cool stuff like that. So it's a lengthy enough game for a Shantae game. It's not going to Shantae. It's good. It's a fairly good length game. You'll come away feeling satisfied. And quite frankly, I think the game is good. How good do I think it was? Well, I didn't cancel my LRG order of it. So
there you go.
It wasn't enough for me to cancel my order, which means I did like the game.
Do you have the collector's edition pre-ordered or just standard?
Standard. Funny thing about this recent scenario that life has faced us with, in that I still like to have my games, but I feel a lot less concerned for the collector's editions of these things. Like, there's a little nicking in the back of my neck that says, come on, dude, 50 monster cards in the box. You can get the cards. And I'm just like,
dude, 50 monster cards, a steel book.
You're a collector. That's a Game Boy cartridge. Right? They want those damn cards. You said it yourself. You're contradicting your own review.
I did, but in the game, I can spend gems that I get for beating monsters up. In real life, I have to spend money.
You
have to
spell gems that you get for beating corporate monsters up.
That is true. I do need to find more corporate monsters to beat up because, man, I need them gems. but, like, I find myself thinking, like, I should probably hold, like, I want the game, but I want the money. So the compromise is don't buy the CE, get just the physical game, which is what I'm in this whole thing for in the first place, these whole LRG things, just to have a physical copy of the game that I want, and just be good. Because what usually ends up happening is that when we get to the point where the games are all coming out, I don't even care that I didn't get the CE anymore. I only care about wanting the CE when the rush is on to get it. Once it's passed, it's like, it's just a thing that's going on my shelf now. And I'm looking over my shelf now, like four collector's editions that some aren't even open yet, like Summon Night 6. That's got that like years ago.
When there's a steelbook.
And that's how they get you, because I think all of their CEs have steelbooks. I'm almost positive every LRG game collector's edition has a steelbook. I agree. Like, steelbooks look really freaking nice on the shelf. I love the things.
But, Shantae Steelbook, I might be okay. Sold. Yeah, if you want to check out the collector's edition, it's available at limitedrungames.com. Pre-orders close June 14th, so chop chop, get on that. It's open 70 pre-order. Bucks.
If you're like me, you just want the physical, it's a little bit more affordable, so it can still be in your budget.
And if you just want the game in general, it's 30 bucks. So, Pernell, what's your verdict?
I think it's a solid quality, dance until your ass falls off, buy it.
Cool beans. I am going to be buying this one. I think I gotta get that collector's edition.
Yeah, because I think it's always like a soundtrack, a poster, cards, steelbook. I'm not sure. I think I might have named everything, but the cards were the main thing that was drawing me in.
The Game Boy cartridge.
Those actually irk me more than anything. I'm like, I want it to be playable. Obviously, it can't be, but I want it to be. You can just put the old Shantae on it. Just something.
Dude, do you know how expensive the old Shantae is?
Shantae?
It wouldn't be if they put it on that limited edition cartridge.
I got it on the 3DS virtual 3DS. Console. Yeah, I got it on the 3DS eShop. Yep.
There you go. Like, just,
and it's
just
still ridiculously expensive.
It's freaking ridiculous. I don't understand the collector's market anymore. I just keep my games and smile about them.
I don't know. I just hate Nintendo keeping that Xenoblade steelbook out of America. Those bastards.
What you mean for them? Out of America? You mean the one that's coming out this week had a steelbook?
Yeah, in Europe.
It doesn't have a steelbook. Yeah, in Europe only. Mm-hmm.
That's a shame they didn't, because the second game had a damn steelbook. They would have matched.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Good old Nintendo. Anyway, next game to talk about is called Red Wings Aces of the Sky, developed and published by All In Games, released May 21st on the Switch for $17.99. Red Wings Aces of the Sky is a dynamic action game that will put you in the middle of amazing battles from the pages of the history in a brand new arcade gameplay style.
Does it say pages of the history, or was that just you not being able to read? Okay, just
from
checking.
The pages of the history in a brand new arcade gameplay style, straight off of Nintendo's website, so blame them. Witness aerial dogfights from the breakthrough stage of the history of flight, when the courage of pilots bordered on insanity and the stakes were never higher. Tim, tell us about Red Wings.
Stakes have been higher.
Description sounds like a freaking Soul Calibur sub game.
It's World War One. I mean, the stakes were high. I don't know if they were the highest.
I think what that is that they used to cook steaks on the engines while they were up there.
That's efficient.
Yeah. And they couldn't do that after that because, you know, the engines were enclosed in like a compartment. So at that point, the stakes indeed were never higher.
Christ!
All right, I'm sold. All right, there you go.
There's a review.
Hook it up.
And we're done. All right. Yeah, Red Wings, Aces of the Sky. This game is set during World War One. You can play as either side, the Triple Alliance or the Triple Entente, as it was. Not the Axis and the Allies. That's what it was, World War One. They're not trying to make you play as Nazis.
That's good.
So yeah, but yeah, each side has a campaign. What this game, it's a 3D aerial dogfighting, mostly dogfighting, but, you know, aerial combat game. Think, the touchstone for me is like the old Rogue Squadron games, except obviously it's not Star Wars. So less cool. Those stakes were high. They were very high in there, cooking those stakes. So you pick a side. You choose a campaign. There is a bit of you know, story fluff to it, to both sides, which it is well produced in the voice acting and the music, and the visual presentation of it. It's like I believe like comic book type pages, like 2D stills. I was just like, whatever, skip. the writing end of it, what did not capture my heart. But once you get in there, you're flying around a 3D space. You have you have four abilities that are on cooldowns. Your one is like just a quick 180 turn. One is a barrel roll. You can also do a barrel roll in this game. One is, it lets you call in it lets you call in / sick more guys in your squadron, more planes in your squadron onto specific enemies. And the last one is is weird, because when an enemy gets low on health, you can use this ability to finish them off. And what your dude does is he pulls out a pistol and then just shoots them. That's the big finisher. There's some other bonuses to that, like it refreshes your cooldowns, but it's just silly, like they're already almost dead, but here, I'm just gonna, just to swag on you, I'm gonna pull out my freaking bolt action pistol or whatever and just like do you one like this, just
oh, put a slug Lord. In you.
Give him one of these,
give him one of these. So the missions, you know, they range from like, oh, here, shoot a bunch of, you know, shoot down X amount of enemy planes, to like, oh, I need to shoot down just like the enemy spotting balloons. You need to shoot down, like, you know, you have to shoot down specific targets, or you need to protect specific targets. That kind of just like general mission structure. Between missions, on each mission, it rates you, gives you a certain number of stars for your performance, and those stars can be spent as currency to upgrade your plane. You can upgrade all your abilities. I just dunked points right away into making it so that when I summoned allies from my squadron, it summoned more of them. I'm like, one plane? No, I need four to come in immediately. But, you know, other stuff, just like your better armor damage against armored planes, better armored planes where their armor regenerates, just like it did in World War One.
Yeah.
I don't know, some like motherfuckers just out there like pounding plates back onto his plane after he gets shot off. Something. Yeah, you know, better armor piercing, just better general damage, better cooldowns, better. There are bombing missions, which take place from an overhead perspective, where you have to bomb targets on the ground. They'll upgrade your bomb cooldowns and your defense against the kind of the shrapnel shots that will shoot up at you. One of the things I really liked is that your upgrades carry over between campaigns. So if you play, you play through, I don't know, all the way through one side, when you start up the other side, you are fully upgraded, like right off the bat. And that is great that you don't just have to grind through that again.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That is awesome. At the same time, I kind of wish that there was more to distinguish the sides from a gameplay perspective, as it is the exact same tech tree and the missions are not wildly different from one another. But it's fine. It's not a super expensive game. It plays well. It looks nice. I reviewed another, you know, 3D shooter game last night that did not play particularly well, but this game, it feels good flying around in the air. Like the aiming of your machine gun, it goes where you it felt good. It goes where the shots went where I thought they should be going. You know, there is a mechanic where you can like zoom in a little bit. So I guess your dude must pull out like a little telescope to look out to get better aim on enemy fighters. But you know, just like nice clean interface has a map on it and gives you good idea of which way your targets are. Yeah, it's a fun little 3D dogfighting shooter game.
Well, then for $18, what is your verdict?
$18. Oh man, I thought it was 20. I think it's a little bit bare bones, but it is fun to play if this is something that interests you. I think it is certainly worth a try.
Cool. Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Tim, that's it for you. I guess we're gonna let you get going.
Work in the morning like a fucking idiot.
Oh, back to work?
I have some special things that need attention this week, so I actually have to go into my workplace for a bit.
I go to work like a fucking idiot. Like, the nerve.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it is a little dumb at this point, but you know, who can help?
Yeah. Well, I gotta, I work at a school and they're trying to get some stuff recorded for video graduation presentations. So I am the guy who does that. So gotta go in and get that done. And
shocked that they got you to do the video stuff.
Hopefully you'll be making a lot of kids happy at least.
Keeps, who cares? They're so cute. Gives a shit. Make their parents happy. That's even worse. All right, but yeah, I gotta go do that in the morning. But yeah, thanks, y'all.
Any final words, Tim?
Shantae.
That's a good final word.
Shantae. All right, we got to move on. Next game to talk about is called Invisigun Reloaded, developed and published by Somber Studio, released August 22nd on the Switch and PS4 for $19.99. Also available on PC and features full crossplay, the ultimate stealth battle adventure where everybody's invisible. Risk versus reward guides your journey through the full-length single-player campaign and local and online multiplayer. Vigilance is key as environmental tells such as footprints and other disturbances will point out careless cadets. Chris, tell us about Invisigun Reloaded.
Okay. Where to start? All right. So Invisigun Reloaded is like, so it's one of those things, I think I've mentioned it before, where it's like some people like who make these games like will just take a simple concept and just run the hell with it. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly that. And this is maybe the most ambitious game I've ever seen to utilize like such a simple idea. And when you like there's games where, of course, that that kind of take the multiplayer battle thing and sort of turn it on its ear. There's that Screen Cheat, I think, is that one.
Yeah.
That one game, which I tried, and I was like, okay, it's a first person shooter and you can't see anybody. You have to use their thing. I get it. And, you know, I played a few rounds and I was like, all right, I'm done with that. But this one is like, I felt like I had taken on like a new career started learning how to play this game. That's not to its detriment, though. I'll get to that. Okay, so Invisigun Reloaded is a top-down action, like competitive shooter platformer type thing. It will look the most to you like Bomberman. You imagine the Bomberman, top down view, players on the screen and, obstacles in between them and, in destroying each other. That's the basic gist. In fact, one of the planets, because there's several planets and each planet has, a lot of levels that are in them. And one of them is called a classic, quote unquote, and it's very much a Bomberman level. So that's, they definitely know about this. So you basically pick your character and, everybody else picks their character and you populate this map. And as soon as the timer goes down, and everybody's ready, they all turn invisible. You can't see yourself, you can't see anybody else. This is how the game plays. Now, it's basically kind of a hide-and-seek as well as, like I said, a Bomberman-style game. So if you shoot your gun, your character then will appear on the screen for like a second, and now people know where you are. if you bump into a wall, the wall will shake and will flash your color. You know, if you're red, green, blue, or yellow. And then, you know, people, if as long as they know where they are, they can then find you and then try and shoot you, as long as they can get there without without tripping over anything, essentially. if you walk through water, little like puddles appear, and so people can hear that. The only thing that you get that nobody else gets is feedback. Literally, the controller shaking when you take a step, like a little bit of feedback. And if you're listening really closely, you can hear like your own footsteps, but not anybody else's. So yeah, it's basically all about sneaking around without any idea. Well, without any idea where anybody else is, but you know, only the vaguest of ideas where you are.
Yeah.
This is a game that will teach you how to count very quickly, because if you tap the directional button, which I recommend over using the stick, honestly, your character will move one square, and every level, as far as I can tell, without exception, is divided into squares. So there is a math game that you can play with this game and be like, okay, well, I need to get there, so I need to go 2, 3, 2, 4, you know, whatever. and you have to do that in real time. So obviously you have to do it really quickly, or count on other players doing it really slowly and then predict where they might be, in their counting. That actually is a legitimate strategy that, you can do. And, yeah, basically, the types of games that you can play, there's 7 different ones. And so there's a good variety of like different things you can do. Of course, your classic survival mode. There's a King of the Hill mode. There is a, you know, you're constantly respawning heroes and, you know, you just try to rack up the most kill points. An interesting one where animals pop up out of the ground and you have to go stand next to them as they go sink back into the ground so that you can collect coins and, you know, less violent. Yeah. And then there's the casual party set, they call it, which is basically like a little less straight up violent. Like the there's the carrier mode, which is like that thing of holding the ball for the longest time. And deadline, actually. The most kills before the deadline wins. Okay. And then land grab. So lots of different, you know, of good variety of like your typical party games and things like that. Of course, the game is up to 4 players. So here's where it gets interesting. There's a lot of characters in this game. I don't know exactly how many. There is a hero guide. It's like 10-ish. I don't know. Each one of them, of course, has the regular shot, and you can actually unlock different styles of shots, but I believe they all do the same thing. You know, and it's a one-shot kill unless your character has some kind of special protection that you can gather in the level because there are items and such. But every character has a different secondary ability, and it ranges from, like, one character, like, can stomp and actually cover a good amount of ground around them. So if you kind of approximately know where your opponent is, you can, like, finish it off quickly. I notice online a lot of the better players tend to use this character. One character literally has a jump. They can jump and double jump and change directions. Switch
directions while jumping, yeah.
Yeah, switch directions while jumping, exactly. You got the character who can call in an airstrike, which causes an explosion that goes in a kind of cross pattern in a few squares. One character can dash, like, you know, there's like all kinds of like different weird things. And they actually rate them on how easy their second ability is to use. Like, there's some characters who have much more involved characters. Like, one actually deploys a drone that will highlight the other characters very briefly. It basically not cheats, but you know, it cheeses that. And then if your cooldown happens while that thing's still in the air, you can actually zap them with that and shock them and then go in and make your kill. Some characters use decoys that you can then control while your character remains stationary, so you can kind of hide and send out a non-lethal version of yourself to distract the person, and then when they kill your decoy, you run in and like kill them. Like all kinds of crazy good stuff. And the game, like in an effort, you know, it's funny too, because like the, you know, it's very sci-fi and spacey looking. And the overall arcing story, if there is one, is that everybody's like enrolled in an academy. And that is actually kind of how you feel about this game, because every single character has a set of 9 custom levels that you can play through. That's just puzzle and like platforming and things like that. Basically trying to get to the end goal. And as you do it, you learn every single facet of how your character controls. And if you can play through all of them and beat there's a boss at the 9th level, then that actually unlocks like emotes that you can use in online play. So you can kind of like, you know, in a sense, kind of flash your badge that you're very good at this character. and you can even unlock other heroes this way, which I recommend, because you can look at the character guide and see the characters that are locked away. And like literally one of them is a combat teddy bear.
Oh, and, nice.
I'm trying to get that guy now, but anyways, so all of this, of course, like I said, you can create a battle with yourself, and up to 3 other bots. And you can set the bots, intelligence, essentially. You can play with other people. But the main thing is playing online. This is very much an online game. It seems designed from the ground up to be an online tournament style thing. So I got to play a few rounds, of course, and it is that really is where most of the fun is. Like, especially if you get pretty good at a character and you like you're able to like really play to their strengths, and you know you can take down people again in those 7 different types of games. And although mostly like I've just got into survival, because I would just set mine to like no preference just so I could get into a game. And yeah, typically everybody was playing survival.
No.
But yeah, like it just, you know, plops you in there, and the only communications you can make with other characters, at least on Switch, is to just, you know, use an emote, essentially. and they get like those, huh?
I would like to point out on the Steam version that if I were to complain about anything about the game, it's that when you're trying to matchmake, it doesn't look for, oh, this person is looking for a game and this person is looking for a game. Mm-hmm. It's if you don't ever find a game, try to host one instead.
Yeah.
And I literally set, I just out of curiosity, I set the game to look for an online match, knowing I was going to get my ass kicked.
Right.
And I set it just to look, and I left it running in the background while I was doing other things. And 2 hours later, it was still sitting.
Wow.
Right.
Wow. So you can't tell me that there wasn't somebody else searching, at least. So if you at least had 2 people searching, if the netcode would go, oh, shit, nobody's hosting, but they're both searching, let's put them together.
Right, yeah.
That would be great.
Yeah, that was the problem I ran into early on. Like, the whole first few days that I had this thing, I just couldn't find anybody to play with.
They do have a very solid Discord community, and they recommend that you join Discord to find people to play with. But
they actually advertise that in the game screen. They even advertise their Bandcamp and their wiki page, which is, you know, a much more involved, like, you know, tells you everything. I guess it's a fandompay.com wiki, which I normally don't like those, but anyways, theirs is pretty good.
I think this is one of the cases of like the base of players around the game really fucking love the game.
Yeah.
Yes.
And everybody else is like, yeah, that's a game.
And yeah, and
it's fine with it.
I really think that has to do with how involved they are in getting you to learn how to play the game, and especially your own characters. I mean, if you think about it, you master 5 characters, you have to go through 45 levels that are tough. Like, they're actually really tough. They even, they're like, if it gets to be too tough, you can actually set it to easier, and it'll put a shadow version of your character.
But it doesn't record your time or anything.
Right, exactly. If you're into that. But the game is, like, they're pretty generous with, like, having plenty of, like, trophies and things like that. So if that's what you're going for, too, then, yeah, you need to make yourself invisible and learn how to play. Ultimately, I mean, there's a lot to this game, and like I said, they host their own tournaments too, and if you win one of them, then they congratulate you in the actual game title screen, which I'm seeing right now, they got four names on there. So, and none of them are mine, trust me.
No.
But yeah, like it's one of those things where if you want to invest the amount of time to get really good at this game, it's definitely unique. I don't know of any other, even the like more gimmicky type of like competitive games, like aren't this involved. And, again, this is like, the levels are set up in such a way, and like the art style is so good, and you know, it's really, really fancy pixel art. And, you know, everything that's built around this game, it's like they really, did their best to accommodate this, you know, unique gimmicky style of like playing the game. And so I really think that drives people to be like very passionate about it. However, I will say, even though I got my ass kicked every time I played online, I did get some hits in. So being totally invisible is a great equalizer. It's not one of those things, you know, where people can just predict where you're going to be and win every single time. Like, you can actually get a foothold in this one. It may take you a while to win some stuff, but you know, if this is basically a time investment that seems like it pays off pretty well.
Well, then for $20, what is your verdict?
$20, I would say it is definitely worth it, but definitely bear in mind that the you know, if the game is 80% online, it's about 20%, you know, it's like 20% single player. Like, the online is so much larger than the single player campaigns. And, you know, I don't really get why you would try and master a character just to not use them. So yeah. Definitely, if you are an online player and you want to play something that is like really interesting, that has a good community and stuff, then $20, it's definitely worth it. I would not expect this game to be any cheaper. It's very well made.
Cool. Cole, any thoughts?
No, I definitely agree. I think it's solid worth for what it is. And it justifies the price. It's the pixel art is really pretty.
It is very good.
I wish there was a little more fine tuning in the netcode so that you could actually just find somebody.
Yeah,
that's a good point. I agree with that.
That's my only real complaint. That and the difficulty, but that's my only
The difficulty
real
is so baked in, though. Like, they. Mm-hmm. They're like, well, we made it as easy as we possibly could without fundamentally changing the entire game.
I did appreciate that they did have the shadow mode and like you could still figure it out. So I mean, even that I can't particularly bitch about. It's just that I sucked.
For sure.
All right. Well, next game to talk about is called Ion Fury, developed by Void Point and 3D Realms, published by 1C Entertainment. Released May 14th on Xbox One, Switch, and PS4 for $24.99. Shelley Bombshell Harrison takes on a quest to slay the evil transhumanist mastermind Dr. Jadis Heskel in the streets of Neo DC. She leaves a trail of carnage throughout huge multipath levels filled with gigantic explosions, more secret areas than we can count, and inhuman foes behind every corner. There's no regenerating health here. Stop taking cover and start running and gunning. Purnell, tell us about Ion Fury.
Well, Fury puts me in a really bizarre place in Review Town, and it's very rare this even happened, in that I suck at this game. Like, I really, really suck at it, and I've been stewing on the potential for it, and it's going to come up in the review, and people will have to judge based on, well, like a review in general anyway, but have to judge based on what I say. That will specifically determine if they're interested in this game or not. But to go into the description of the review, Ion Fury is essentially what would happen if someone took Duke Nukem and Doom and Quake and Hexic, all those styles, classic style, like sort of 3D, but also with 2D graphics, and just like came up with a new game, and then released it to be identical to like one of those games. Like it was lost in like a game that was lost in the 90s and now has surfaced. And you would get Ion Fury. You are essentially going from level to level, usually either just trying to survive to the other end of the level, or at the end of a series of levels, you'll have to fight a boss. However, as you're playing through the levels, your functionality is very straightforward. You can walk, you can jump, and you can fire your gun, one of whatever guns you're finding you're holding at the time. And when you use a gun, typically they have a sub-function and a primary function, which means that each gun can get like two different actions and way they fire. As you explore levels, you'll come across a variety of items as well, such as health packs, which will restore your health, or armor packs or armor bits, which will increase an armor gauge so that when you take a hit, you will lose armor instead of your actual health. Now, as base, the game is awesome. It does a very good job of replicating the style of graphics that those games that it's inspired by have. I did actually read somewhere that apparently they use the exact same engine that games like Doom used, like Duke Nukem used, hence why they did such a good job replicating it, because they use the exact same engine. But it looks really nice. You even have the character portion in the left corner, a la Doom, that gets a little big, it gets banged up as you take more damage. As you walk through the level, every once in a while, the villain will chime in. He'll have some funny quip to say to you, or faux evil quip to say to you, and then Shelly Bombshell will say something hilarious, because honestly, this thing is chock full of, like, 90s style, like, action movie banter. Like, oh, you really pissed me off now. I just spilled all of my bullets on the floor. I'm pissed. I can't even come up with anything, but just think of that, but cheesify it with some extra cheese, and you'll get the kind of dialogue that she'll say, whether in response to enemies or in response to when the villain speaks to her or what have you. And at this level of the game, it's great. Like, I loved experiencing it. I loved seeing it. The problem, and the thing that kicked the stuffing out of me, kicked in when it was time to actually battle anybody. Even at, like, the lowest setting, your character moves snappy fast. Like, cursor is fast. Character movement is fast. You're just zipping around, which is great for just traversing a level quickly. Not so great when you're trying to have precision gunfights with jerkbag 2D mom enemies that are fighting against you. However, the other thing that makes it really difficult, too, is the fact that you need to be fairly close to dudes, in my opinion, to get a good shot off on them, unless you use, like, something like, say, the starting pistol's secondary action, which is like kind of like to drop a target on an enemy and then fire homing bullets if the reticle overlaps the enemy whilst being triggered. So it's a good way to kill dudes. But if you're not using that, and even sometimes when you are, you need to be fairly close to aim the gun properly and take enemies out. This is extremely difficult to do, and you will find yourself whipping around and trying to get over dudes and just not quite having it. And even that wouldn't have been, per se, the deal breaker, because it would just imply that, okay, the usual auto-aim kitty gloves are not in this game. So you got to aim and fire properly to kill dudes. But the thing that makes it really hurt is the fact that enemies are freaking crackerjack shots from so far off the screen that it's a wonder that they can hit anything, let alone you. And it doesn't matter if you're moving around. They'll still pop you. But you can't see their bullets most of the time. So all you'll hear is some random enemy chatter, but since it's kind of like just out there audibly, you don't get an indication that's coming from anywhere. You just hear an enemy, which indicates there's a guy somewhere in the area where you have no freaking clue. And then all of a sudden you're getting shot in the back or the side or the top of your head. You don't freaking know. It's just bullets hitting you from someplace. And it usually results in you just dying or getting drained stupidly fast. And it's irksome to me. There is a save function that you can do. I like those old style PC games where you can just kind of like stop anytime you want and save your game or load your game. And to be perfectly blunt, save scumming is the only reason I was able to get anywhere in this thing. Because what would usually happen, I would go into an open area. I'll start taking bullets. But I don't know where bullets are coming from because I can't see any freaking butt. I eventually find the enemies, attempt to kill them. Keyword is attempt, because sometimes I would still freaking die. If I survive the skirmish, I check my armor levels and my character health levels. If they're too low from when I started the skirmish, I flat out reload the pass save and try again until I get it right. Now, someone might be saying to themselves, well, geez, dude, why don't you just own the damage and just keep going, see how far you get? Well, I could do that, except health is not the most common thing to find. It's out there, but it's not the most common thing to find. And armor gets drained so fast that in some respects, it's not even worth having it on at all. You can barely tell you had it. And I need to emphasize this point that I played on the default difficulty, the one that was quote-unquote intended as the designer meant it to be. Yeah. So not like I put it on like super hard like I usually do, because I punked out on that real fast. but I couldn't bring myself to go below the default difficulty. I still have a little pride. Not saying that other people need to be that way, but just I couldn't do it. So it was a bit nerve-wracking to just like get hit off screen, lose like 20 armor points, finally win, but realize I'm already on the verge of death and I don't know where armor items are, because while you can see them on the ground, a lot of times it's hard to even see what the tinier pickups are because they blend into the scenery in such a way that I kind of found myself just like running around hoping I stumbled across something because I couldn't see it like off the bat. With that said, if you're the type who's like, well, that guy clearly sounds like he just sucks at FPSs, and I love classic games from the 90s in this style, well, this game is probably very much up your alley, because aside from the fact that I sucked balls at it, it was very authentic to the style of gameplay that I remember from back when I would play Doom or Quake, even a little bit of Duke Nukem, or hell, maybe even a dash of Wolfenstein, but in that game you couldn't jump, so whatever. I just couldn't jump at Doom. I digress. Point is, the game does a very good job of replicating the style of which it is intending to pay an homage to. So you're going to get your bang for your buck on that. Just know that unlike in the past, enemies are freaking crackerjack shots. You're going to die a lot for things that you have no control over because you don't have x-ray supervision. And you'll be retrying a lot. But who knows? Maybe you'll enter an ultra instinct mode or something. And all of a sudden you'll be seeing digital bullets before they come at you. And you'll become a super killer. And you'll beat the game. And you'll write in the SML podcast and go, Pernell, you fucking suck at this game. I beat it on super masker mode. You wish you were this good. And I'm going to say, here's a cookie. Perhaps you'd like to eat it because you deserve it.
I deserve a cookie.
Well, you ain't beat the game. You ain't no cookie for you. None for you.
I did play it, though.
Oh, what was your take? I'm curious, because I know you're pretty okay at FPS games. What was your take on it in that regard?
I don't know that I really want to go back and talk about it.
Sounds like you probably had a similar experience then.
No, it wasn't so much that it was, you know, I didn't find it particularly difficult beyond, you know, being what it is, but I thought it was very, very old school, and there was a lot of dated humor and gameplay into it, and I think I would have enjoyed it more if I'm the kind of person who really gets into that nostalgia bit.
Yeah.
And I'm not. I remember playing Doom and Wolfenstein and shit like that as a kid. And so I was really like, oh, I'm going to be super into this because, you know, badass female character for my favorite type of gameplay. And then I just was like, well, this is a thing I did. Also, my mic just fell out of his mic arm. I was like, this is a thing I did. And that's about where it's safest for me to leave that at.
I can honestly I can agree with that too. Because like I thought about that while playing the game. Like, it's not the sort of thing where I can personally dock it for it, but from a review perspective, as a Pernell perspective, there are some genres that feel like, do they need to get that retro revisit in that manner? And this in particular may not have been one. Like, I'm glad you made the comment you did, because I didn't even think to mention this in my description of the game, but like, so you get a melee weapon in this game. It's a electric baton, right? You would think, okay, this is the logical thing you can use. You can run up on dudes and melee them when you run out of bullets or if you're trying to conserve ammo. However, all the enemies are 2D flat plane guys who are walking around. What does that mean? It means good fucking luck aiming and nailing a melee attack on a 2D enemy that is flat that you can walk through.
Yeah.
You're not going to do it. You shouldn't even have a melee weapon in this game because you'll never be able to properly use it. It was annoying as balls. And it also probably makes it harder to find some of the enemies on the screen too, because if they turn, it's just like this little weird cardboard thing. Like it was frustrating. Like when 3D and FPS games evolved into a 3D state, which made them more playable in a way that to go back. Aside from pure nostalgia, like what were games like back in the day? You don't retain much of the fun. Like you take an old classic platformer and go, okay, what it was like when we were playing Mario 2 or Mario 3, they still work. They still work to the letter. They don't lose any of their charm. They don't lose any of their playability.
There's nothing like a nostalgia shooter to make you realize why games have evolved the way they have.
No.
Yes. Yes. I'm glad you mentioned that, Cole, because you brought the perspective that I didn't know quite how to word. Like,
that's
you
what I'm here for.
Also, for cookies.
That and overbearing feminism, because Joe was like, please don't bring that up during this show.
Done.
Yeah, I don't even know if that content is still even in the game. It may have been scrubbed by this point. It's not even worth dwelling on.
Yeah, there was a plan for them to remove it. I don't know if they did.
I'd say when the episode's over, just tell me about it, because I am curious about it. But tell me when the episode's over, because I want to know.
We need to know, $25, what is your verdict?
If you're in for the nostalgia styling of this game that we were talking about, then it's probably worth the price for you just for that alone. However, if you don't need the nostalgia and you want it from the perspective of how playable is it, I think it's less try. It's like it leans more towards deny than try, but it should at least be a try because it does what it's set out to do. The question is what it's out to do what you want? So let's go with try it generally. Pretty much a try, unless you don't want to try it, then say screw it, don't buy it.
It's one of those games where if you already know that that's your thing, it's going to push your buttons and you don't need us to tell you that you're going to like it. But if it's something that you're on the fence on, just let it go.
Mm-hmm. I got to get those cookies to you, Cole.
I do like cookies.
I have Sour Patch Kid Chips Ahoy.
What?
Yes.
What?
They are real and they are spectacular.
Ew.
Sour Patch Kid Chips Ahoy. I had to buy them specifically because I always rattle on about how I want cookies to start doing things like put jelly beans in them and sell them on the shelf. Stuff like that. Sour Patch Kids are the next best thing. Someone decided to try to do it. It works somehow. So it's weird and I like it.
Okay. Moving on. Next game to talk about is called Pixel Cross Adventure, developed by Score Studios, published by Plug-In Digital, released April 16th on the Switch for $9.99. Pixel Cross Adventure takes the classic nonogram logic puzzle and turns it into something never before experienced in the genre, a story-driven RPG-style 2D graphical adventure. Follow our heroes Scorchan and Gig and Professor Matrix as they tackle their most daunting challenge yet. Chris, tell us about this one.
Okay, so the Pixel series, which actually contains one of my favorite of these games, which is Pixel Lines DX, I guess, which is actually has two entries. This is basically one, and it is like actually a puzzle game that is wrapped up in a story with characters and things like that, which is actually kind of unique for the genre. And this one has the same characters. It's, Scorchan, who is a little kid who has a grandpa, some older relative, who keeps inventing stuff that Scorchan then, tends to ruin and, then has to solve puzzles to fix everything. Only in this case, there is actually an evil entity about Mona Chromatic or something like that. Like, she's trying to destroy all the colors of the world and using this, like, puzzle technology kind of thing. So she sets about zapping everything, and, not only does it zap away all the color, but it tends to actually zap away the item itself, and then, like, it creates, like, this little black hole. So as Scorchan, you are tasked with basically walking around these different areas, like an RPG, and you solve these puzzles by walking up to a black hole and interacting with them. And as you solve them, you gain more levels. And as you gain more levels, you can take on bigger puzzles and bigger challenges. Basically, once you've cleared an area and you go over to the next area, then, you might, if you try to go for the biggest puzzle, you might not have a high enough level to actually take it on. But then you have to, like, take on the smaller puzzles. And, the puzzles are all nonograms, which is basically like Picross. I think that's what the gist is. It's a grid that is blank. It's just, a grid of like, you know, maybe 10 by 15 or 5 by 5 or, you know, any amount of like, you know, kind of thing like that. And on each side, on the, you know, x-axis side and the y-axis side, there's a bunch of numbers. And those numbers represent how many spaces are supposed to be filled next to each other. So if there's a 2, then that means that there's 2 squares on that line going in that direction that are supposed to be filled out. And you don't know which ones. You have to use the context of the whole puzzle in order to figure out, like, basically what squares to fill in order to draw a picture. Sometimes a puzzle will have a really easy tell, like it'll have like, you know, it'll be 10 squares across and one of the numbers might be 10. Well, that means you just fill them all in. And then from there, you can kind of, you know, more easily discern, you know, because if there's like a 2 on the line above that 10, then that means that definitely that, you know, one of the lines or one of the blocks from that 10, you know, one of its neighbors is definitely the other one for that 2. So, you know, it's just, it's logic. You just kind of keep going with it. The game has a very nice tutorial for teaching you how to play this type of game. If you haven't before, all the pixel games do. And, yeah, the puzzles start off real easy in level, you know, 1 where you're, you know, basically, you know, trying to, bring back the items in your own house. And then eventually you go out into the world. And the cool thing about this is that every area actually ultimately has a boss level, which is interesting. Usually it requires that you're at the, you know, near the max level where, you know, you could be at that point. So, you know, you defeat all the smaller puzzles first. But the boss puzzles are actually 4 grids put together, and you solve, you know, each one of the 4 grids, and then all 4 of them put together make a very complex picture.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And plus, it actually takes away your ability to kind of guess by, you know, if you figure out eventually, like, oh, I get what this is supposed to be. And then, you know, you kind of like use that to determine what you're doing. You know, that's a way that you can go. So there's a couple of other things that this game adds in that I really quite like. One is the clue roulette. So if at the very beginning of a puzzle, at no penalty to you at all, you can choose to have it solve a single line going sideways and, you know, up and down, like a single X line and a single Y line, and it'll just pick one randomly and just solve it for you so that you can then, you know, begin working. Because oftentimes with these puzzles, it's like, it's much harder to start than finish.
Yeah.
Like these always, they start at the apex of difficulty and then get easier as you keep solving. So yeah, like some of them, I was able, and the other thing is that they time you on how fast it is that you can do these. And, let's see, I'm sorry, I was confused by a thing on this. But yeah, there's things where you can like reset the whole puzzle. You can ask for clues. You can do like things like that. Like the game's very accommodating to folks who don't want the full challenge of like a blank grid and then, you know, just figure it out. And yeah, like they basically also changed the graphic style. Like it used to be that the whole game was, the stories would be told in just still shots of like just drawn characters and stuff like that. In this one, there's actually like a pixel style and an 8-bit soundtrack and things like that, which is kind of cool. But you know, ultimately the RPG part's not super important. It's just a framework to throw in a whole bunch of puzzles. And I do mean a whole bunch of puzzles. Like once you finish the first area, which is like the outside of your house, like you can walk to like several different places and like just start working on puzzles. So
yeah, I think the store page says there's over 300 puzzles in the game.
Yeah. And that's typical. That's typical of the pixel games, though. Like, they really are generous with the puzzles for the yeah. amount of money that you pay. And, of course, this one's kind of cool, too, because what I like also about the pixel things is that Scorchan is very, like, very charming, very funny. Like, the game's got, like, real personality to it, which I really enjoy. And they didn't even need to do that. Like, they just, you know, decided to make
it. Score Studios puts a lot of care and personality into their games, and I really like them.
Yeah, so basically, yeah, at the end of the day, it's if you really want a charming nonogram puzzle like type game, then this is I really can't think of anything to complain about with this one.
Well, then $10, what's your verdict?
Yeah, absolutely worth it. I mean, if grid puzzles are just absolutely the worst thing in the world to you, I would advise to stay away. Because, again, there's no real RPG to it. It's just bits of storyline that interrupt, you know, just lots of puzzling. But as far as, like, if you are a fan of nonogram puzzles, this does actually present a fresh new way of looking at it. And if you're wanting to get into this kind of game, it's a very good teacher. Especially, like I said, for the fact that it has the clue roulette at the beginning. So
yeah,
that's actually really cool. So yeah,
awesome.
Worth it.
All right. One final game to talk about tonight is called Crypto by Paugi, developed and published by Lightwood Games. It released May 19th on PS4, May 21st on the Switch for $7.99. Crack the code to reveal the quote in this classic cryptogram puzzle. Decrypt the ciphers to find 180 funny and inspirational messages. Chris, what is Crypto by Paugi?
Okay, Crypto by Paugi is a cryptography game, which actually is one of the worst puzzle games for me, historically. but we'll get to that. So basically, the way a cryptograph works is that you are presented with a completely, like, with a blank document, essentially. You know, you just get dashes for the amount of letters that are, you know, that will spell out a message eventually. Underneath those lines, you have letters that are just nonsense. Like, you just, there's no rhyme, you know, well, obviously there's rhyme and reason to them, but they don't spell anything by themselves. The idea is that you change each letter to a different letter so that, you know, every instance of that letter occurring will then change to the different thing. So if, like, there's an F and, you know, you change it to I, everywhere on that puzzle where F appears will then turn into I. And you basically use that to kind of figure out, like, what's being said. And, you know, inherent in the English language, there are clues. For instance, if there's just one letter as a word, well, that can only be one of two letters.
Yeah.
So, you know it's going to be one of those, so you just punch in something. And so what this game adds to the cryptograph is that you have, you know, of course, a grid of, you know, the letters that appear on the puzzle, and you select one, and then you can just choose any letter from the keyboard above it, and just punch it in, and you can just punch them in all day. And that actually takes a lot of the work out of cryptographs, because normally cryptographs are known for eating up erasers.
Oh yeah,
because, you know, if you're trying to do a classic, you know, on paper cryptograph. So this one, yeah, you just punch in the letter and it crosses out the letter on the alphabet and then puts it underneath the letter on the grid. It crosses out all of the letters that don't appear in the puzzle, so that does that work for you. Like, you know, if K and L and whatever don't appear, then they just are grayed out on the grid below.
Oh, that makes it really easy.
Oh, I know. It's like, that's the cool thing about it, is because, like, all of the busy work is taken out of it so that you can just do the brain work and you can make a lot more guesses, like, a lot quicker. So having said that, I went from being terrible at cryptographs to actually getting through a few of the puzzles that are, you know, definitely, you know, on the easier side, but still, I was able to actually get through several of them. And, you know, of course, it's Paugi, so while they don't give you the terrible puns between stages, the actual messages themselves are pretty great. Like, the second puzzle in the whole set is a Stephen Wright joke, and I always approve of that. He's one of my favorites.
Nice.
And yeah, that's pretty much all there is to it. There's a soundtrack. You can turn it off if you want. It has dark mode if you like that. So it goes from, like, a white background to a gray background. Those are the only options in the game. And like I said, it has 180 puzzles. Interestingly, you can't look ahead, I've noticed. So you kind of do have to go through the puzzles rather than just pick, you know, a random one and just start going. So, but that's fine, because, I mean, like I said, this is it's a very fun genre that, like I said, I've just been traditionally bad at. So
yeah,
that's oh, and I will say as well that the game will actually give you an ability to check by pushing both of the shoulder buttons if there are errors, and then it'll, you know, then ask you if you want to fix whatever errors there are on the puzzle, and if you do that, it just erases whatever letters you messed up and leave the ones you got in. Obviously, this makes the puzzles a little too easy if you're already pretty good at this, but it is a good way if you're just really unsure. If you're just like, I just can't tell if this is an I or an A. You know, you can then just punch in one and check it, and if it says it's fine, then it's fine. You can move on.
Yeah.
So that gives it a nice fail safe for people who absolutely are hopeless at this genre, again, like me.
Well, overall, 180 puzzles, $8. What do you think?
Like every PAUGI game, absolutely worth it. I mean, no question. And in fact, if you have been intimidated by cryptographs in the past, this is a great way to get introduced to them. Because, like I said, it takes all of the guesswork out of it. And by the way, I kind of misspoke a little earlier. Like, you can choose whatever puzzle is on a page. I just think you can't turn the page until you're done. No, you can. Never mind. I found the button.
Proud of you.
Yeah, you can select any puzzle in the game.
Good job, so, Chris.
I will amend my review before it goes to print.
Poor Chris, leave that man alone.
The last quote is from Oprah Winfrey.
Oh, Lord.
Whoa. Just thought I'd throw that out there.
Figure it out live on the show right now. We're not ending the show until you figure out that final puzzle.
Oh, boy.
This is what happens when you don't play the game until it's time to review it.
No, I played it for hours.
I'm giving you grief. I am 100% convinced that you don't play until it's time to review it.
No, that's fine. That can be my my secret.
Your first playthrough is live during the show every time.
Yeah, I mean, that actually makes me sound cooler than I am. Not every time. I think that actually makes me sound like cooler than I actually am.
All right. Well, that is it for this episode. Thanks, everyone, for being here.
Thanks for having us here. It was a Jizzy Jimmy Jam.
You said that like we have a choice.
It was a what, Pernell?
It was a Jizzy Jimmy Jam.
Jizzy?
That doesn't mean what you think
Jimmy
it means.
Jizzy Jam.
Jizzy Jam. Words.
Jizzy Jimmy Jam.
Nope, Jizzy.
Nope, too late.
Jizzy like Jam.
Pill. That might be a garbage pill.
Oh boy, do I have some explaining to do with my husband now.